All right. We are officially recording with the number one pen seller, the number one art supplies man in the United States online. Probably not in the stores, no. There's way too much volume in stores, but... ladies and gentlemen, the famous, spectacular businessman, Irshad Ganji, who is the founder of Mr. Pen, which literally right now is in the top 20 Amazon sellers by volume, meaning units sold, seller ratings. You can check it right now. And I'm lucky enough to share this little bit of time with Mr. Irshad. Welcome to the show, brother.
Hey, Aaron. It's good to see you. Thank you for having me. And you're too kind with your words, I think.
Well, Irshad, I mean, it's all true. It's all true. I mean, honestly, you sell... Do you have a unit, like number of orders or units that you sold last year? Or do you keep track of that at all? And do you know what it is?
I think about 60,000 units a day.
60,000? Are you serious?
Yeah. On FBA, we don't fulfill ourselves. So
60,000. No wonder you're kicking my ass. Are you really totally serious? So you sold 21 million units last year, approximately.
Yeah.
Wow. That's unbelievable. You know, that's almost 10% of the entire population in the United States of America.
So we sold, maybe I'm off. We sold 12 million units. I'm sorry, 12 million not units? 21. 12 million. Okay. So that's what, 30,000?
30,000 a day. Okay.
So I mean, that's maybe in our good days, it's 60,000.
And then what about the revenue? Like, I know average order, right? How much dollars is that?
We are on the low side. So I would say $8. $8 is where we are on the average order.
Wow. So you've grown though since last time we spoke. So you did like 90 million last year or what?
High eight figure, yes.
High eight figures. So over 80 million.
Yes.
That's crazy. I thought when we met you were like at 40 or 50 million.
Yeah. It grew. Amazon grew too though. If you saw market, I don't know if you follow marketplace pulse, is that it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think Amazon grew 50, Amazon FBA sellers grew $50 billion. That much more. Wow. Like the third party sellers.
Yeah.
So if I grew from, let's say, 50 to 80 or, I don't know, 90, and you do the math, that's like, I don't know, 0.08% of that big growth. Wow. It's nothing.
No, not nothing. No, I'm sorry. I don't think any person on the entire planet will agree with you that you growing $30 million in revenue in a year and a half or something like that is a small. Like, no, like, that is that
it's
is amazing.
Not small, but compared to whole Amazon, you know, the growth you see. When you do the math, it's, man, that's only like 0.01%.
Okay, but there's a different math, okay? I like math, so let's share math. It looks like you're a math guy. That's how you got here. So if the Amazon revenue was around 500 billion or 550 or 500 or whatever, let's say it was 500 and I went to 550 billion, which is somewhere like that, or went from 550 to 600, right? 550 billion to 600 billion. It only grew about 10% in a year. Mm-hmm. You, my friend, grew from what? Do you know your last two years of figures? What was the last 2 years?
So in 2022, we did 66 million.
And then last year?
Ish. Last year, high nine figure. I mean, high eight figure.
So, but what does that mean? Eight, you didn't calculate it yet? You haven't done your...
90 plus.
90 plus. So that means you grew a lot, dude. That's way more than 10%. Realize if you would have grown 10%, you would have been at 70 something. So you grew 36%. That's ridiculous. That's massive. That's huge, right? I didn't grow 36% last year, and Amazon didn't grow 36% last year. So just recognize you are a killer. You are amazing. You literally crushed the market. So we're going to talk about in here in this podcast, like, tell me your tips and tricks, because I actually want to know. I do this podcast so I can talk to people that I want to talk to. And instead of that one conversation disappearing for the universe, some people can also learn from it. So what the hell did you do last year? Like, why? Well, how did you grow so much?
Man, I think we added a heck load of products.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I think 2022, by the end of 2022, we had about 470 SKUs. Now we have 1,500 SKUs.
Wow.
Projecting this year, I don't know, 2,000 something. And then wow. we had a policy. It wasn't a policy. It was a way of thinking that, hey, let's not do variations, you know, before.
Yeah.
So 2023 is the first year that we started doing more variations. So that made the job much easier to add new products.
Okay, but where did you learn that though? Where did you learn to do variations though?
I learned it from the Zulaya Kitchen.
Yeah, baby! Okay, so it's safe to say that I helped you make tens of millions of dollars. So let's just put it that way.
Of course. We just went on, looked at the milk product on Amazon and said, hey guys, let's just copy that. You see that?
But you're being serious, all right? I mean, I know you're on my show, but like for real, we met like shortly. We met, and then you said, "Hey, let's do this." I love this. So what'd you do? You just did colors. You did pack sizes. Because I haven't seen your catalog recently. I haven't honestly looked. So, what was your strategy about variations?
Yeah, mostly colors was easy. Different pack sizes is easy. It depends on the product sizes. You know, different sizes of the same product. But mostly colors is the main thing.
Yeah.
And then we kept adding new products too. So that was part of it. We never did variations before because we were too scared. One, we were too scared. One, we thought it's too easy. You know, we thought we can do that anytime we want. Let's do the hard part first. Let's add new product. And but we were missing, you know, I think that was a mistake. We were missing the opportunities.
Wow. That's amazing. So you tripled your SKU count. And then, so in terms of staff, could you give me a bit of an idea of like, how many people do you have in your company now, you know, with 90 million revenue?
We have 17 US people, which work at our warehouse. We have a warehouse here.
Okay.
And, I think 17 to 20 people overseas working.
No way.
On the e-commerce and then what side, I guess.
And what about the rest?
That's about it.
That's it? You have 40 staff? Not even.
Yeah, give or take.
So you don't have a US team like in operations?
No. I mean, I'm here in the US and I have a partner in the US. We have an employee in Puerto Rico that does mostly admin stuff, and then the rest of the people are overseas.
Wow, dude, this is a bit crazy. So you literally have, 34, 35 staff, okay? But hold on, because I think there's a bit missing. Does that include your developers or no?
Yes, three of them are developers.
How many are developers?
Three developers. So,
dude, I don't understand. Okay, this is crazy. So, but hold on. What about before when you were doing, you know, 50, 60 million revenue? Did you have the same team? Have you added at all? When you added 1,000 SKUs, you didn't need to think you didn't need to add a bunch of people for that?
Yeah, I think we were almost the same size that we are right now. So we try to do as much automation as possible. Try to use our developers to do that. Make it easier and easier for the salesperson to look at the sales and all of that daily. So get notified on different changes and stuff rather than looking one by one, you know, that way you don't have to look at 1,500 SKUs or ASINs. You look at, I don't know, 15 or 20 a day and just make decisions for those. So that was a big difference, big part, but it's funny how it happens. Usually, the people we have take a vacation for a week, you know, and then we see, oh crap, business going down. We need to figure something out. Now we either have to go hire somebody else and say, okay, how can we automate that guy's job?
So which jobs have you automated? Like when you say automated some guy's job, which jobs have you successfully automated?
The main things are the logistic part. Like to decide how many needs to be ordered, how many needs to be shipped to Amazon, And those decision makings are the hard ones. That's the thing that takes time. Otherwise, everybody can go on Amazon, make a shipment. Sales, looking at sales, pricing, you know, deciding what price to put for different products, make those decisions. That's the, those are the hard part. PPC, it's not fully automated. Again, it's something manual that we need to do, but it's mostly by just looking at notifications and not looking at the whole PPC thing that you're running. But any job that is really like related to decision making, those are the ones that that take a lot of time, right? And then obviously you have a thought process when you do them. Anybody that's doing it, even no matter how complicated it is, you say if this, then this, if this, then this, if this, then this. If you write that, then you can automate that, even okay, on so, Excel files, you know?
Are you part of this, the developers? Do you meet with them and tell them exactly what to do? And do you write some of this logic out, your if-then statements?
Not really. We usually just tell them, well, we call it a wireframe. So we tell them what we want to see. We do say, if this happens, then show this. If this happens, then show this. But we don't, I don't think any of us know coding part of it.
Okay. So, so you, right now you're forecasting, predicting what you need to order. Okay. Who developed the actual strategy and like how that gets coded? Like, again, the logic, not the actual code, but did you decide yourself how to order? And if you did, tell me what is that? How does that look like?
So it's not a, it wasn't an overnight thing, right? So, you know, when I first started, it was in my backyard right here. So that was a different process. Then we went to a warehouse. That's a different process. I don't know. Amazon just added those low inventory fees and inbound placement fee. That will change the whole thing, you know. Now I have to send more inventory to Amazon rather than 30 days of inventory. Maybe we do 60 days so we don't have a low inventory fee, or we remove that somehow. So it's a lot of try and error. At first, I did it because I was the only one doing most of the things operation-wise. And then when we hired the logistic guy, you know, he learned as he goes, and now he does that. Now, we tell him the outcome. We have some red lines that we say, hey, we should never run out of stock. So do whatever you can, as much as you can, up to a certain dollar amount, you know, or profit, let's say freight divided by sales price, however much, let's say 50%, but don't go over that. If you want to go over that, come talk to us. And then write the algorithm based on that. So you can decide if you want to send inventory from China to Amazon FBA with error, as long as it's, if it meets those criteria, do that. If not, come talk to us and we all make a decision, you know.
So someone again, still does it. I mean, you have the computer, but that's not automated. Your ordering is not automated. Which part is automated? Like, well, how does it work?
The part that takes time is the decision making. Like, how many I need to order right now? That's the part that takes the most time. Once the computer tells you, okay, you need to order 10,000 or whatever units, then you just press a button. An email is sent to the supplier that, hey, we want to order, then send it. Like a PO goes, they send an invoice, then it goes to accounting and all of that, you know? So.
No, I don't know. I do this all manually. I don't know because I don't have an animated email sequence when I say push a button and the PO gets made. I mean, it sounds brilliant. It sounds like it would save a lot of time and it's amazing. But I have never heard of anybody making this. I've thought about it, but I don't know anybody who does this other than you right now that I'm talking to.
So. Let's say, okay, we have the sales figures, we have the seasonalities, and then we have our inventory figures in the US, how many are in order in China. Based on all those numbers, we come up, the software can come up with the number suggestion, you know, hey, we need to order 5,000 units. And we have the MOQ of each product. So we need to order, I don't know, 7,000 units right now. And then once that one person obviously needs to go and make sure that number is correct, you know, it's not way off. And once they approve that, they click a button and a PO is sent to the supplier. So the PO is sent, the supplier, I don't know what the supplier does, but they send us an invoice. Yeah. So the invoice, again, once they send an invoice, automatically the invoice is sent to our accountant email, which is connected to bill.com. Bill.com make that invoice in the system, you know. Again, bill.com can notify you when the invoices are due, and you can just by click a button, you can pay them.
Wow. I might have to do this.
Yeah. You got, yeah.
Can, and so
it's not all butterflies and roses either, though. Like there's a lot.
No, but it sounds like
it. Wrong.
It sounds amazing.
It's very simple when I talk about it, but you know, when you get into the grinds, you see, okay, there's this issue. There's so many exceptions in the middle, you know, that you gotta think and have your developer. Okay, we didn't think about this scenario. Let's build something for this one, you know.
So now that you have the system that works, have you ever thought about, or have you ever successfully integrated with another person other than your own company to use this software?
No, and it's so customized to our business and the business model we have. I don't think.
Well, I have the same business model as you. We have the same business model. We design a product somewhat. You know, you do a white label.
Maybe
you
it works
it,
for
you order it.
Maybe it works for a business that. So, like, if you add Walmart to the equation, you know, it or Shopify, let's say, then I have to develop something for that. Right now, this is made for Amazon.
So, do you? What's your share of Amazon revenue versus other revenue?
99% more. Okay. More than 99%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Don't remind me of that.
So no, but I mean, look, you talk. I just had Gibran Niaz on the podcast from Utopia Deals. Okay, this guy's at 700 million.
That was great.
700 million in revenue, just Amazon, just like yourself. Maybe I'm just overthinking things and trying to do all this other stuff because you're just Amazon. He's just Amazon. Like what? Do you really need something else? I don't know. Maybe you don't. So I don't know if it's a bad thing. It sounds fantastic to me.
I don't know about the longevity of like an Amazon business that's solely Amazon business, unless you're Gibran Niaz, who have you know your own
or
factories.
Or Arshad Ganji. Then, I mean, like either one, like you know.
Well, I don't have a. I mean, that's a great question, Aaron. Like, what is my edge over a Chinese factory on what I do? Amazon makes their job much easier, so easy. They can almost anyone in China that makes a product, they can sell on Amazon. Actually, I went to China last year in April, and I went to I don't know the bigger factories that we work with, and all of them they sell on Amazon now, and they all said, "Thank you, Mr. Pen, for showing us how to sell on Amazon." I said, "I didn't show you. I said we just followed your lead." You know, and they do good. You know, they have good pictures. They have good pricing. Everything is good. And they automated their factory. Like I went there 4 years ago. It was all like manual labor. Now they have machines going on and they're selling well. Now they are in one niche. Like I sell many products, but let's say they're selling highlighters and they are my factory and they're doing it themselves too. And they're kicking
but are you
butt.
Selling more than your factory? Is your factory starting to pass you, or how's that going?
I think I still sell more for sure.
Yeah,
but I think they definitely make more money because they're a factory. You know, I have to. I don't know the margins.
Well,
for
I mean,
me lower
look, I mean, from them. What I understand, the factory margins are only like 10%. Well, I mean, I guess Amazon. Let's just actually to enter this conversation. What are your margins for your business, right? Like like let's say tax return level, like net after all the expenses, right? Let's say you did 90 million in sales, 90 or 80, I keep forgetting, but
90 plus.
What's your margin? What's that?
90 plus, but okay. Margin is about 8-9%.
8 or 9.
Net margin. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a boatload of money, guys. That's a and you're up. No, at some point, or earlier, when, I think when we spoke a while back, obviously, if you don't add staff and you add 25 million in revenue, you know, your margins should be going up. But when we spoke last and you were around 50, 60 million revenue, 66 or somewhere in that range, your margins were lower. No, something like, so where was your margins then?
I think last we met, where did we meet? Los Angeles. I think we were at like 5.5.
Right.
6%.
Yeah, 5.5-6%, guys. And a lot of people would say, oh, that's so bad. But the thing is, what people don't understand, if you're at 5.5%, but you're at 60 million revenue, you do little changes like you did, boom, you get to 90 plus, you get to 8 plus margin, and you just made a boatload of money, and you change your business in a very massive, massive way, because you have an asset that you're controlling. You're the captain of that business. And so you can always change your margin, you know, but you can't change the fact that your company's only selling 3 million, and you're at, who cares your margin percent? It could be 100%. You're still not Mr. Penn. You know, so it's amazing.
Yeah.
So
one thing about margins, though, like an Amazon business, this my CFO tells me this. By the way, I have a partial CFO. I didn't count that as staff because they're not part of our company.
Just, all right. So 37 staff. Sorry.
Like he tells me, hey, you are not an Amazon business. You are an operations business. Like, it doesn't matter what you sell on Amazon. You can sell whatever you see around yourself. It's how can you bring the margins up higher and higher, you know, through making your company more efficient, you know, your warehousing, your shipping costs, all of that. So, and he's true. I mean, he's right.
Yeah, it's amazing. And realistically, you guys are almost at $3 million in revenue per employee. Okay. That is, that's extremely, I mean, that is like ridiculously high. You know, we're closer to like 1-to-1. So you're basically almost 3 times more efficient than we are. So, I mean, I don't know how you're doing or what you're doing, but it's amazing. So far, my takeaway, I need to launch way more products. I used to be in that frame of mind and I kind of stopped. So when you're adding products, like I know you talked about variations, but what is your strategy and like, how do you pick the next products to launch?
So then there are a few strategies, you know, and we did a lot of try and error to see what's the best strategies, but I would say you definitely want to keep your market share. So you are in, I don't know, your best product is milk frother.
Yep.
And you don't want to lose that. So add as many product as you can related to that market, you know, because once you lose it, you might lose it forever. Might not come back. So that's the first strategy. Secondly,
so if you're so let me just take it for someone else. Let's go back to pens, right? So if you have like, let's say you have some markers, you want to do felt tip markers, you want to do permanent markers, you want to do highlighter markers, you want to do multiple colors, you want to do different sizes, you want to do fat markers, skinny markers. This is what you're talking about, merchandising around your category. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So if whatever people know you as, you know, say, hey, I don't know, what does Mr. Penn sell? And when your customers, you know, say, hey, Mr. Penn, the first thing they remember, what is that market? Is it pens, highlighters, or for you, milk frother, garlic press, whatever it is, you want to keep that and just add as many products in different categories of the same product as much as you can. So that's our first strategy.
Yep.
Frequently bought together, you know, if I'm selling something and they're buying it with a competitor, I might as well just make that other thing that the other person is having, you know, and then try to buy them together. Try to have the customers buy those together. So that's another one. That's the two main ones, really.
Okay. So and you lead it by the customer.
There are some
the
others.
Customer's leading. Yeah. Oh, what others? Okay,
yeah.
Okay, tell me, what's the other one?
I mean, this, like, let's say if I'm selling glasses, Okay. And I see Stanley Cup or Simple Modern. It's so good. You know, it's so trendy. But it's not glass. So what if I make my glass shape like that? I don't know. That's just thinking. You take a risk. It might be good. It might not be good.
Yeah.
I make a coffee, I don't know, coffee, whatever, tumbler, but glass. But that looks like that. Something like that.
Nice.
So you look at the market and based on the trends. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically, that's innovation, really. You're talking about adding something that doesn't really exist yet.
Yes. And this is one that we struggle the most with, like, because it's a risk. Sometimes it's really good. Sometimes it's a big fail.
Yeah. So then, and when you start a product, right? So you're saying, hey, you're going to add felt tip pens, right? Because whatever, people buy those. Or you're adding permanent markers. Or you're adding, I don't know, a marker that has a tip on both sides. I don't know if you sell those, but like, let's say, good. We just started with both sides now.
Mm-hmm.
And you've added now 1,000 of these in a year. What has been your success rate, like your percentage of these products that actually end up being profitable, and how much do you discontinue?
Good question. It really depends on what you call success. You know, how much margin do you call success?
I call success making more money than break even. If you made back your money and anything, I would say that's successful because you're getting reviews for free in that case.
I think a contribution margin 20% or lower is when we call it unsuccessful.
So what does that mean?
So that means what? That means sales price minus cost of goods minus Amazon fees.
Okay, gross margin. So you have a gross margin.
Yeah.
Without ads.
Gross margin.
Without ads. Yeah, meaning if you have to price it you lose money at the beginning, then that's a failure.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I mean, that's not you might launch it that way, you know, and then, but
sure.
you have a period of time and say, okay, after a month, I need to see where I am. And if I can get where I want to be, let's say gross margin more than 20%, then that's a good product. And then it depends. If you sell one unit a day, no, that's not a good product. But if you sell
correct
more than 20, I would say it's a good product. So 20 units at 20 plus percent margin, that's a success. Now,
because what I see is, if you're not taking into account the ad costs, to me, if your gross margin or contribution margin is 20%, but then you don't run ads on it and it still sells, I'm fine with that product forever. If it's making 20% margin, you don't calculate after that?
The ad cost is part of that.
Oh, interesting. So you're really talking about the net. I call that kind of the net profit. Like the products. Okay, so you call that contribution margin. Fine. I mean, I haven't used that word, but you're saying the product, if you didn't have any salaries, staff, rent, anything else, like how much did that make, right? So that's the profit. When you're talking about Amazon fees, you're including advertising. You're saying good sale price minus all fees, ads, storage, refunds, product cost, everything else, what you have left over, you want that to be higher than 20%. Well, yes. In your case, if you're selling a product,
I want that, and I call that the success.
Yes. You know? Yes. Now, again, realize, and I just want to put something in perspective here, right? For me, I have items that sell. I have, for example, a coffee machine that sells for over $800, right?
Mm-hmm.
For me, if I'm at 10% of that, I'm good because every unit I'm making $80, right?
Yeah.
So there's a difference on the margin. When you have an $8 product, if you have a 10% margin, that means you're making 80 cents, right? It's a little different, right?
Yeah.
I would say, you know, if you make a house, if you're selling a house in real estate, you get a 1.5%, 2.5%. And you're like, damn, you just made hundreds of thousands of dollars. So when your price goes up, I think that percentage, the acceptable, goes down. But at your price point, I do understand that's 20%, right? You need to make more than a dollar per unit. Like, please. It's basically what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So,
okay. So then
I would
with
say
that
the success rate is about 40-50%.
So half of them eventually don't make it. And when those don't succeed, What is your thought process? Do you like revive those from the dead and new images and new video and change it and new ads and you put a lot of effort, or you just say, good, that's not a winner. That's not a winner. Drop it. Go to the next one.
But we try to revive it maybe one time and see what happens, you know? And if it doesn't work, that means it's not a good product. And then usually by bringing the price down, you can make it work.
Yeah.
Meaning, okay, now profit margin on this product is not going to be 20, but it's 10. It's still good, you know, at that 20 units per day. What if I bring it to 20? How many units I sell per day for that? 2 or 3. Okay. Now I go to the factory and say, hey, can you bring the MOQ down to 1,000 units rather than 5,000 or whatever it is? And then if they say yes, then we would order it and sell at 1 or 2 units a day or 3 units a day at 20% margin. If not, then it's dead.
Okay. Okay, so the product, no matter what kind of profit, if it makes $5 per day, you generally say you keep it as long as you don't have to have, you know, years of inventory.
Exactly, yeah. So one thing that I think adds a lot of value that almost I haven't seen any Amazon seller that think about this. And this happened when I wanted to get a loan from a bank. And they came and it was an asset-based loan on my inventory.
Okay.
And whenever they did, they said you need to have an obsolescence policy.
What the hell
means? With the inventory, you have to have a policy. You can call it however many years. But the bank wanted to me to set a 2 year. So whatever inventory that's going to sit in my warehouse more than two years, it needs to be calculated and then subtracted from my profit. It's a loss. So for example, they said whatever inventory you have that's less than 6 months, that's nothing. But from 6 months to 1 year, we say 25% of it is a loss. From 1 year to 2 year, we say 50% of it is a loss. From 2 year on, we say 100% of it is a loss. That's another thing that made us, hey, we can't have this much inventory at hand. Like, it's a risk.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, that is true. I believe in that.
Yeah.
You know why? I've seen companies, so we actively buy companies, and I know you've bought companies too. I know you bought a really fantastic brand. And you've been growing it. But we've seen in acquisitions, when a company has 4 years of inventory, they're saying, hey, I don't care if I'm profitable, just buy my inventory at cost and I'm good. People are discounting their valuations because nobody wants that. Because if I'm buying a company, I put down money and I want to see a return on my investment, right? I want to see 30% on my money. So if I put $1 million, it should bring me, you know, $300K. If I need to spend $2 million of inventory, but it's profitable making 300K, I'm now making an 8% or whatever it is on my money, and I don't want it. So when you have excess inventory, it makes it very hard to sell your company because it's dead weight. So, I mean, I'm just agreeing with you that...
Exactly. You know, maybe for you that you go and buy companies, that would be a point of negotiation for sure. I'm telling you, like the bank, use that excess inventory on my P&L, said this will bring your profit lower. Your profit is not actually $1 million. You have $200,000 extra inventory. Your profit is $800K, not $1 million. So your multiple it's going to be 2.4, not, you know.
That's true. And I want to tell you why, because it's an unrealized loss. Because one day you might have to dump it in the garbage. Right.
Exactly.
And that's happened to us where we have inventory and like it's profit inventory, you know, IRS counts inventory as profit, but you know, you're going to have to dump that inventory. And so you have fake profit when you have that inventory. So, I mean, I tend to agree with that bank. I mean, so you have 50% success rate, right? And you're adding products. Do you mostly add products with your existing factories? Or are you going out and like finding new partners to work with and expanding into new categories?
Yeah, so I don't work with the factories directly. That's one of the differences between us, I think. I work with traders.
Okay.
And I think that's number one of the, I would say, top two reasons that I could grow fast. Because I didn't have to look. Yeah, but it could be a liability. Like at some degree, at some point on, you know, it, like maybe right now I'm where, hey, I need to work with the factories directly, then because I can save the cost because they add some margin to it. But I'm still working with the trader.
So you work with like one trading company and they do absolutely everything, or multiple? Like how is that structure?
Yeah, one trading company, they do everything.
Are you serious? Yeah. That is unbelievable. Well, that makes ordering so easy because one person takes all your orders and all your PIs and everything, your POs.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Somebody got really lucky when they got your business. Oh, how did you find this company? Like you met them here, you met them in China. How did you get one company to get all of your business?
So we worked with Alibaba on, you know, when we first started Alibaba, and then we happened to work with this guy. Back then I had no idea of what supplier is, what factory is, what the trader is. But the first person that showed up, the price was okay. We ordered, and then we kind of grew the relationship with them. I tried a few times, you know, I go to China at least once a year. I try to go to the trade shows, and it doesn't work as I think, or it's not scalable as I think, unless I build an office in China with employees and, you know, to get after it. But for me to go on WeChat.
Irshad, hold on. This is the most strange thing I've ever heard. Okay. So you work with one company. You're not working with factories directly, yet you go to China every year. So what's the thought process behind this?
Well, I'd go to Canton Fair. I try to go to Canton Fair once a year to learn, mostly to learn and see what's trending, what's new, you know, and use that. I mean, I talk to the people at the booths and try to get prices for what I'm selling, use that as a leverage to the person that we are buying from right now.
Okay.
And I go meet them, you know, meeting them helps a lot, you know, with the relationship.
Meeting your main contact, your main company, the trading company you work with.
Yeah. How much, you know, the payment term with them. It, just go over that. And then what else? And they bring me to the factories that we are working with. So when I go meet the factories, they just bring me.
Oh,
so we kind of have that trust, so they know I'm not gonna go around them to the factory.
So you made an agreement. You said like, "Hey, we're gonna work through you forever for a few years." Did you sign anything, or how does this?
No. We're gonna work through you as much as you make sense and you do good work. So, not, I know there are products that we say, "Hey, this is not working, we are losing money, unless you can go to this price we cannot do it," and they say we cannot, then we go find somebody else. But then I say one supplier, we might have eight, but 99% of our supplies is with one, you know.
Wow.
The rest of them is just one product here, one product there. And
okay,
I guess you
so for you
very
finding products, yeah, right, so for you finding products, you still work with the same company and you say, "I want to have this," and then they're going to do the work. So you kind of have more people on your team because you have these guys that is your sourcing branch. You don't pay them by employee, but they might have 10, 20, 30, 40 people working just for you.
Exactly. Yeah. And they do. I mean, I visit their office. They have a lot of people
that like are working just for you.
I think they do some other business, but again, I think 95% of their business is me, and then they have 5% of whatever they used to have or still have that.
Wow, it's really incredible.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so now when you're adding products, you basically go to them and then you say, "Find me this type of product." Do you generally try to change the product? Do you make it better? Or you're just saying, I know you guys have pretty inexpensive products, very affordable. Do you just say you can make the same thing as what's on Amazon and just cheaper? Or what's your strategy to add products in that fashion in terms of price versus quality versus uniqueness?
No, we usually just copy what's on Amazon. Yeah. Because as soon as I change it, we changed it. We put a lot of time, and then we put it on Amazon. It sells well. It only takes like 2 weeks for some Chinese guy to come and sell under price us. So we might as well.
Did you ever try patents or anything? You didn't try to patent anything?
I haven't, but there's nothing that I don't like. It takes so long. Let's say this pen is a good selling pen right now because of the shape. Yeah. By the time I get a patent, this is not going to be a good selling pen anymore. Some other new pen is there that looks better.
I mean, it might. You know? It might. It might, by the way. A patent might cost you $500, $1,000 or something. Like,
yeah,
I've tried.
And it didn't work as well. What worked for us is to be fast. We got to be fast. Yep. Like as soon as we see a competitor's there and they have a good product, we go and, hey, let's copy them. We're going to be the Chinese copier.
Yeah, yeah. You know? No, sure. But here's the thing, right? But you're generally the lower price, right? I mean, you are going to find someone and a lot of times you're lower than them or no.
Yeah. Well, we try. We try to be the best price. Yeah.
So, and that's the thing. So it's not just copying what you're doing. You're taking a product that's popular and you're making it more affordable. So you're still bringing value because somebody would want to take the product at a cheaper price with the same quality, right? I mean, that's a massive value. That's just how all the dollar stores are open and they're booming. These guys make billions of dollars because they'll say, I'll give you something that's not going to be the best quality, but it's going to cost you $1.50, you know?
Yeah. And we try to be the best quality. Like I tell the banks also because they ask the same kind of question. I say, hey, look at Amazon Basics. That's exactly what they do. They have all the data. They know what's selling. As soon as they know it's good, they go make it. And if you look at Amazon Basics, I haven't seen any Amazon Basics product that with 4-star review. Show me. I don't know.
They're all high, right? You're saying they're all 4.5. Yeah.
Yeah. All of them are 4.5. And Amazon kills the products that bad. That's how it keeps the brand healthy. Say, okay, if you buy from me, one, you buy the cheapest option. Two, you know you get a good product. Mm. So we try to be the same.
Nice. If possible. I love this. That's brilliant. Okay, good. So we're rolling. All right. So, Irshad, so we kind of had a little bit of technical difficulty. So not everything, like, anyway. It's been an amazing podcast. It's been absolutely a spectacular podcast. I mean, I had so many takeaways from this interview, and I love that I could like have this talk with you, and we can share with people because we need more entrepreneurs, more people. And by the way, I don't know if we talked about.
So tell me, just say where you're from, just because I think that's important for people to know.
Mm-hmm. I'm from Iran originally, and I came here in 2009.
What
are you? I came to the U.S.
Are you serious? How did you get a visa, or how did you make it here?
Yeah, I went to school. I studied petroleum engineering, and I got a master's in petroleum engineering. That's how I got here. And then I got married, and I worked in the oil field for 5 years, and then got laid off. Started. This.
And then wow, that is amazing.
Yeah.
So you're really truly a story of a. Of an American success, right? That you came here to this country for opportunity and for all the things you came here for, and you found it, and now you are a leading entrepreneur for everyone to see. And so I want to just tell people that story, you know. And you're also, you obviously came here, I mean, not obviously, but you came here legally, which is awesome. And
Yes. There's
opportunity for people to like you to do this. And Amazon, I mean, I don't know. Do you think you would have had any like success in any other field, like the level you've had on Amazon?
It would have been hard. I have a good story about that too. Like we tried because Amazon, that means my partner and I, when I went to the partnership, we always thought Amazon is something that it's going to stay small. We're going to keep it small. Let's go to the tech. Let's make an app that does something crazy, you know? And we tried a few times. And, the last time we did it was in 2019. And we spent about $70,000 in investment in some website that we were developing for music copyright and all of that. and it failed. We call it a failure. It failed. It was generating money, but it was a failure.
Wow.
Then it clicked, hey, let's scale our Amazon. Like, if we just put the same amount of time and focus in our Amazon, we could scale that. So we didn't think before when we started, for sure.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I found it, for me, it's obviously been the most easy thing, because I've failed at a bunch of stuff too. So I mean, I think that when you find something so beautiful like this, why not scale it? Why not make this amazing and bring, you know, great products to the market? So I appreciate you, my friend. Thank you for sharing this time with me. And if anybody wants to follow you, do you do any social media? How does anybody like reach out to you if they want to, or they just go, they're going to support the support website on Mr. Penn, or
they can. I have a LinkedIn. They can. I don't usually post anything, but they can message me if they want. And yeah, my email is airshot@mesterpen.com. If somebody wants to, you know, email me, that's fine.
Amazing.
Because I usually don't check LinkedIn messages much.
There you go. Wonderful. Very generous of you to share that. And all right, guys, Irshad Ganji, top 20 Amazon seller right now. Freaking legend. Thanks so much for coming to the show, and we'll talk again.